Hi, I'm John.
And I'm Ron, and this is Digital Divination on the No Direction Network.
All right, here we are for Digital Divination 21, our first episode of 2021.
Excellent.
What do you know?
Wow, episode 21 of 2021.
Sweet. Yeah. Did we plan it that way? I don't think so.
From the beginning, actually. We had to miss one in order to make it happen. No, we didn't plan it. It was entirely lucky.
Well, you know, if we were smart when we did episode 20, that was the last episode of 2020, we would have said that too. I didn't even think of it.
Maybe people picked up on it. They're like, why are they waiting for us to say it? They're like, it's even a longer than usual episode. They must mention it. But we didn't.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is, you know, all the thinking was that 2021 was going to be so much better than 2020. And I think the jury's still out on that.
I probably will be. Right now, we're still on, December 41st of 2020?
Yes. In terms of, you know, what happened in the Capitol, and then, you know, the COVID numbers are still through the roof, and it's like, yeah, I'm just kind of waiting here for things to get better. They said it was going to get better, so.
Yeah, it's sad to see, and I've heard a lot of people making the comparison, well, things are bad at the Capitol. Think how much worse it would have been if the protesters were people of color instead of white. And although I initially agree with that, I want to make sure it doesn't obscure the fact that people getting hurt in a protest means things aren't working right.
Yeah, you know, I was wondering about that because that was one of the things that really stood out for me is like, how are these people allowed into the building and, you know, kind of putting all these things at risk and basically doing something that hasn't happened but one time, like in 1812, you know,
right,
where the Capitol is kind of has an invading force that comes in. And, you know, it kind of occurred to me that maybe, well, two things. You know, the obvious thing that everyone's kind of talking about is, oh, the fact that they were not of color, they treated them differently. I don't know if that's 100% true. I mean, possibly there's some truth to that. I think another aspect of how they're different, the group that came in was basically wired for violence, and many of them were armed, you know, I'm sure had concealed carry permits and things like that. And I think the folks there, the Capitol Police and everybody there, knew that if the shooting started, it was going to get really bad, really fast.
Yes, yes.
You know, compared to the other protests, the Black Lives Matter protests, you know, every other person's not carrying a gun, just waiting to use it, you know?
Yeah, I've been to a couple of the Black Lives Matter protests here in the area, and literally the only weapons I saw were those carried by the police. So, yeah, you might be onto something there.
You know, so I mean, that's my rationalization why it went the way as it did, because I'm just thinking, you know, had they started using rubber bullets and started doing flashbangs and water cannons and, you know, all the typical stuff that you see at the Black Lives Matter protests, I think we would have had a completely different story. I mean, it was bad enough. The one Capitol officer there, I don't know if you've seen, you know, the pictures of that, where he was beaten to death by a crowd with a fire extinguisher.
Yep. Unfortunately,
it's just horrific, you know? And I don't, you can say that it's a fringe group or whatever it is, but it's like that. I don't know of anything so abhorrent that ever happened, you know, by Black Lives Matter protesters.
Right. Well, the key difference that I see that I was talking to somebody about the other day is the Black Lives Matter protests are about people who want change in the way people are treated. in this country. Mm-hmm. And this Capitol riot was people insisting that things stay just the same. Right. Mm. That's their fight. They're worried about change. They're like, whoa, things are changing in a way that we don't like. And people are, you know, trying to make those of us who could make the rules and make the noise not be able to do that. And we don't like that. I mean, it's just the character of the two is so different, and attempts to conflate them and compare them, I think, sort of fail on a fundamental level.
Yeah. I think the fact that, you know, there was violence and rioting and property damage and theft, that's what people are saying, you know, happened one time and this is how those folks are treated. It happens this time. This is how these folks are treated. I think you're right. I think it is the basic premise that the folks that are there, the response, everything was a lot different. It was still, you know, as I mentioned that Wednesday night when we were recording for our other podcast, it's like, I was just in shock from what happened. I knew that there were going to be protesters there. I thought something could happen, but I figured that there would be prepared for it. And we wouldn't see potentially people going in, taking their electoral votes, harming legislators. It's just crazy.
Right, right. Bringing in their zip ties to the, you know, with the clear intent to kidnap people right into the chambers. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think it's very fortunate. And then the really ironic thing is that so many of them were live streaming themselves.
Yeah. And then they're surprised when they get fired or they get arrested or really?
Did you think this was okay? And people would say, yeah, good for you.
Yeah. I don't know. I think, yes. I think that, I mean, the honest question of that is I think a lot of these people had been told for so long that something like this needs to be done and that heroes need to stand up and do it, that they had this sort of hero complex. And they got twisted to a point where they're like, I am going to invade a government building. I am going to destroy government property. Even those people to a point where I'm going to bludgeon a police officer with a fire extinguisher because I'm the good guy.
Well, and I can't believe nobody else tried to stop them from doing it.
Right.
You know, I mean, I can see that there's a couple crazy people that get out of hand. How come there's nobody else there? You know, somebody sane in the group saying, hey, you're killing somebody here who's just trying to do his job. What?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's horrific. Oh. And the biggest worry I have, and we can revisit this in subsequent weeks, I assume, is that it's not the first of these types of events that we're going to see in the next couple of weeks.
Well, I think you're right. Maybe that we'll start seeing these rallies of, you know, kind of trying to keep their momentum going from what they had before. I don't know. Anyway, how do we even go? Oh, we were talking 2021.
That's right.
Yes. 1 week in and it's like, oh man. So how's your day going? How's your weekend?
I almost hesitate to say that I've had a bad weekend. I'm a little bit under the gun with some writing assignments that I'm not yet behind on. But writing at my usual pace, even at my accelerated pace, I know I will end up behind on them. And so I've already reached out to the people I'm writing for to say, hey, I'm going to be a little bit late. And part of that is because I was just doom scrolling about the insurrection and not able to do anything else. So I feel like I needed to get a lot of writing done this weekend, but I spent a lot of time with my kids. And that doesn't feel like wasted time in any regard. And so right now I'm looking back at the week and going, whew, I wish I would have written more. But then that's followed up with, yeah, but I don't wish I'd spent less time with my kids this weekend. We had a really good weekend. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's where I'm at. How about you? How was your weekend?
Well, you know, I had this plan this weekend to do a couple things. The main one was to take down our Christmas tree because it was still up. And I told my wife I'd take it down this weekend. So I actually did that Friday. And then she suggested, you know, I made this garage gym. And one of the things about it is it's in we have a 3-bay garage and it's in the far bay. And when my truck is in there, because my truck is so long, I can't get to it. I have to open the door, go around outside and go over it. And so I thought, you know, I'm going to rearrange the garage some. So the first thing is we have a Costco Christmas tree. It fits in two big boxes. So I put them under the stairs in the house. Okay. So I put it on the tree. I did that. And I thought, you know, I'm going to start moving stuff in the garage. And so I took out two complete sets of shelves. I put up two new shelves on the far side. And I've, like today, I spent 12 hours just moving and cleaning. And of course, I find stuff that, oh, you know, maybe I should keep this or donate this. And then I went through my toolbox and organized, you know, and so I've just been going like a madman all weekend organizing my garage and cleaning my garage.
What did you get? Did you finish the job? Did you get the gym moved over to the other bay?
Well, you know, you mentioned let's meet at 9. I said 9:30 because at 8:30 I just finished. I wanted to shower up because I was filthy.
So, oh, fair enough. Yeah, well, good, so, good, good, good. Good job done then.
So it's looking good, and you know my wife is very happy with the fact that I've been going whole hog on a home gym because it's how she got the garage clean. She's been bugging me to clean the garage forever and says, you know, if you build a home gym, you can move this stuff and have lots of space. And so I did it. I fell for that.
You fell for it. She's patting herself on the back. She's going to need some ointment for her elbow, patting herself on the back so much this evening, I think. Yeah.
But, you know, it's amazing. You know, I find stuff that I said, I've had this for 20 years. Why do I have this little piece of plastic that I thought was really neat to do something with? I guess I'll get rid of that. So much of that stuff, you know.
Yeah, I get that. I find things and I think to myself, ah, shoot, I thought I had one of these around here someplace, but when I needed it, I couldn't find it. So I went and bought another one.
Yep.
That happens to me all the time.
Well, so I put things up in boxes and in like containers that we had, and I put masking tape on the containers and wrote what was in it. Right. And then on the boxes, I wrote what was in it. So you can look up there. And if you're wondering, man, I know we got this camping stuff. Where is that? Oh, there it is. Oh, and there's all the stuff that's in that camping box. Because like we were looking for this picnic table for a place in Kamado, tablecloth for the table outside on the deck in Kamado. And I said, I know we got a nice like outdoor tablecloth. We couldn't find it anywhere. And so I found it. Nah. I was very excited.
There it was. Now, I do things like that, in addition to labeling what's generally in the box, I will put a date on it that is 2 years in the future. Now, I'm not going to do this for anything like a photo album, but I'll put a date that's 2 years on it in the future. And if it gets to that date and I have not opened the box, my promise to myself is I will take the box down, put it in the back of my car, and I will go donate it. I will not go looking in to see what it is. If I haven't used it in 2 years, that is a full two winters and two summers, right, for seasonal things, then I'm not even going to remember I've got it, much less use it again. So, but that's because...
I know.
It's hard.
You're so disciplined. How do you do that?
Well, I'm disciplined because I have to be very limited on the amount of space that I take up. I share... I know we don't throw anything away for the kids, partly because that's the stuff that we use to remember them by. You know, their first grade homework is something to remember them by. But it's also the very nature, because all three of my kids are adopted, the very nature of adopted children is they have a tendency toward loss and abandonment anxiety. And so it is helpful to be able to tell them, I'm not throwing any of this away. I am putting it away. I'm packing it away. If you need it in the future or you want it in the future, we can get it. It's not going anywhere. And then, of course, they don't ever need it or want it, and it just fills up my attic and fills up my storage, and so, which means I have to be more disciplined about the things I'm getting rid of to make space for the stuff they've got. So,
well, anyway, so that's what I did, and that's why I'm tired.
Sounds like work well done, though.
It was good. I'm amazed that, you know, I got up at 6 and started working all day. I've been so productive ever since. You know, I highly recommend getting a kidney transplant. It just gives you hours on your day, you know?
Already done. I'll, you can't just go to the store and.
Right. Yeah. No, that's true. I cannot. Anyway, so I was thinking that it's the start of the year and, you know, kind of, our first podcast of the year, that we should talk about starting playing the game. So starting Starfinder. And, you know, I was thinking we'll talk about our process for coming up with and developing a character to play.
I think that makes a lot of sense. So anybody who's, you know, hey, I've been invited to play Starfinder, what do I even do? How do I even start? Might benefit from knowing how we would start.
Yeah, yeah. And I've made, you know, like in society play, I have 15 characters. And then, you know, for APs, I've probably made a whole bunch of others. So I kind of have a certain process. I'm actually really curious to hear yours because I don't think you play as much Starfinder as I do. So I'm curious to hear your perspective.
Right. In fact, I think I could say, apart from pre-gens, I'll occasionally pick up a pre-gen to play something. I've made four Starfinder characters to play. And only one of those was a Starfinder Society character where I had no knowledge of what was going on with the other characters at the table. I would just play somebody to play somebody. But I think that so my general process for the other 75% of the time is the first thing I want to do is I want to talk to the GM and the other players and say, all right, well, what else are any of the other players so excited to play that I know I should steer away from that? So somebody, if I hear that, oh, this, you know, you want to join this group, this other player really loves taking on the healer role. All right, I'm going to step away from a mystic or a biohacker or something like that. Or if I, you know, we came in and we've got, you know, two soldiers already. All right, well, maybe I won't play a soldier then because that kind of loads us up. So my first order of business is what does the table not need? And that's how I start by excluding those things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and so because I make most of my characters for society. Now, when we're playing with APs, I kind of do the same thing. You know, we see who's playing what and find out, you know, what holes there might be. Now, for society play, I just kind of make characters, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, I might have an idea for something. Like I might have a special race boon and I want to make something with it. Or it might be that, you know what, I've got a lot of GM credits and I want to put it, you know, they've been sitting on we call it a GM blob, just a character number just generating credit. So I have a whole bunch of levels I can apply to it. And so I say, okay, I'm going to take this and make this into something. Or maybe like what happened more recently, I'm playing a low level game with some friends. I don't have any first level character, so I need to make a first level character. Mm-hmm. And so those are kind of the different situations, but my process always starts out about the same. I try to figure out two things. One, what type of character I want it to be. Do I want it to be a ranged attacker? Do I want it to be a frontliner? Do I want it to be a skill based character? Do I want it to be a caster take based character? So something like that. And then I come up with a theme, like a name for it that evokes something or a theme for the character. So
not a theme like in a rule sense, you mean?
No. Okay. Like how I want to get and I'll give you one of my favorite examples is Leroy Jenkins.
Okay.
Right. So I have a character named Leroy Jenkins in society play. Now, of course, Leroy Jenkins has probably been used right before. So getting the name Leroy Jenkins is tough because you have to have unique names and for your, in the Paizo database. So I made mine Leroy Jenkins with 3 exclamation points at the end. Right? And it's great because, you know, I think that really signifies what he's kind of about. And I didn't know you could use exclamation. I knew you could use numbers. I bet you can use symbols too in the database. Well, you can't. I mean, exclamation points.
Well, then but if you use nothing but symbols, you'll look like your name is a cartoon character cursing.
Yes. Oh, that's true. Oh, you'd have to put, you know, there's probably a specific order for that.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I said, you know what? I want to do a melee type. I'm going to call him Leroy Jenkins. He's going to be somebody who just kind of rushes in and attacks without asking questions. So he's got to be somebody who's kind of sturdy. And so my character Leroy Jenkins is a Vanguard, which is like one of the sturdiest classes that you can get. They have a lot of they're constitution based, and so their damage modifier and stuff is based on their constitution score, which also pumps up their stamina, right?
So they're necessarily very tough. Always very right? tough.
You know, and I thought, okay, I have these race boons. What would be really a fun one to have for Leroy Jenkins? And so I made Leroy Jenkins an uplifted bear.
Okay. Now this is significant. So you didn't come to the process thinking, what do I want my bear to be? You came to the process mm-hmm. saying, I want to be a melee fighter with this sort right. of theme. What matches that?
Right.
Okay.
Right. So, and that's Leroy Jenkins. And I actually made him first for, I had this idea and I was playing with a group. We're playing through Attack of the Swarm. We're in book 5 now. And I made Leroy Jenkins there first and as a Solarian. Right.
Okay.
And then for society play, I got a boon, which in society play, you have to get a race boon to play the non-standard races versus in APs and homebrews. You can, whatever the GM allows. Right. Mm-hmm. And in society play, I made him a Vanguard. And for both of them, he just kind of rushes in and starts hitting on stuff. And it's a lot of fun.
Well, let me tell you, I actually went, the reason I asked you specifically about that order is because I did for the society character, that I have made my society character. I went the other way. I played a pre-gen in a scenario that let you play a halfling. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, okay, well now I'm going to play a halfling. What should my halfling do? And I had to look over the rules to see what halflings in particular are good at or bad at in the game. And then I'm like, all right, well, this is what I'm going to do with my halfling character. And then I picked the class and sort of the theme, as you say, the kind of shtick for the character. But I started with my boon.
Mm-hmm. Well, and a lot of people do that. I mean, they wanna use a particular boon and they see what fits and you can, that works really well if you look at like a halfling, for example, right? So a halfling, I'm trying to remember offhand, they probably get plus to dext. Dexterity minus strength, I'm guessing.
And a bonus to charisma.
And charisma. Okay, I wasn't sure what the other one was. Yeah, and so I'm looking at that, and I'm saying, okay, if I have a halfling and I'm going to make something with that, that charisma, that sounds really great with the dex for Envoy, mm-hmm. for example. You know, so what class did you end up making?
Well, now just because I said I looked at the bonuses and then the classes didn't mean I made one that was exactly right for that. I made a mystic.
Because
myself, mystics have just enough with the, you know, diplomacy and intimidate, those sorts mm-hmm. of skills. And a dexterity is good for anybody that intends to sort of stay in the back and shoot at people. So I made wisdom, I think, my best, but knowing that my dexterity, my charisma were going to be pretty good, and that would be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think this brings out a point that although certain races have bonuses and negatives to the attributes, it doesn't really lock you into just maximizing those particular ones for a particular class. You can do whatever you want. And there's also alternative race characteristics that came out recently in, shoot, I don't remember. I think it's the Calm
mm-hmm.
where it came out. And that allows you to make, like you can make a strength-based halfling with that, you know? So it kind of changes around. And so all the, you know, a lot of the races have alternative versions. So you can make whatever class you want out of pretty much any of the basic standard races and the legacy races.
Right. And I really think that what that does is enhances it. It reduces the feeling that you've sort of mm-hmm. screwed yourself over. Right.
Right.
If you want to play a melee character, but you also want to play a halfling, you don't want to think to yourself, well, this is dumb. Why did I even do this? Right. We go, no. There are alternate race traits. You can make it so that's not dumb. You can do the thing you wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's interesting thing about the uplifted bear is that he gets a plus 2 to strength and a plus 2 to intelligence. And my melee guys don't really need intelligence, but one of the downsides to a lot of melee characters is they don't get a lot of skill points.
Mm-hmm.
So that the extra intelligence actually helps that.
So what is Leroy Jenkins surprisingly good at? Computers or engineering? What did you decide to do with this unexpected intelligence?
Well, so Leroy Jenkins, because he's an uplifted bear, he's really into life sciences.
Oh, I can see that.
Yeah. So kind of, you know, other critters and things and what happened to him and things like that. So, you know, I mean, he's not going to be as good as somebody who, you know, doesn't dump a lot of points into strength and stuff, but, you know, he's not bad. And Leroy Jenkins, that's the one that's a Solarian, actually has points in charisma.
Well, so, being a Solarian, like, that's important. Yep.
You know, yeah, Solarian's actually a really tough one, because, you know, your primary stat is charisma, so you need to put points into that to get resolve, and you actually can get your charisma modifier to damage, so that's good. You want to put some stuff in the strength as well. Then it's like, well, okay, but constitution's kind of important.
Yeah,
right?
you're gonna be in the thick of things, so you're gonna need constitution. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be slow and cumbersome, right? So you don't want to have a low dexterity. There's a lot of things you don't want to have low as a Solarian.
Yeah, so Solarian's it's a tough one to kind of blend out. So you end up with a lot of, you know, rather than like a lot of characters when I'm building them out, I might try to have the two primary stats that I'm worried about. So dexterity and something usually, 16s, mm-hmm. right? And then the other ones I don't worry so much about, because you know, basically, you know, the next part of once you get your theme is how do you start stacking up your attributes and what actual theme are you going to add in? And you get 10 points that you can move around. So you take your basic, you know, your two pluses and your minus, or if you're just doing a straight human, you get a +2 you can add to something. And then you can take your points and adjust them around if you like as well, those 10 points. And, I forgot where I was going with that.
how to build out your character to meet the core requirements that you've got.
Yeah, and so oftentimes I'm torn between, should I make something an 18 or should I have a couple 16s? But with the Solarian, it's like maybe I'll have a 16, but oftentimes I'll have a bunch of 14s just because of how it's split.
Well, this is one of those places where in addition to talking with the other characters from the outset about what's needed or what people want to play in the party, is I also want to make sure I'm talking to the GM. Because the GM's idea is, oh, we're going to play this adventure path, and it's going to take you to 13th level. Well, then that gives me ideas about what to do with my character's attributes, you know, all their ability scores, very differently than somebody who's like, oh, I want to run this thing. It's going to be like 6 sessions long. It'll be a lot of fun, but it's kind of 6 sessions and that's it, right? Mm-hmm. So that really controls how dedicated I am to looking ahead at the advancements I'm going to get to my ability scores and mm-hmm. positioning my 16s versus 17s and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the big reason for the differences there is that at 5th level, 10th level, and 15th level, right, and 20th, I guess, mm-hmm. I've never had a 20th level character, you get you can boost 4 ability scores, and any score that's below 16 or below, you can boost it by 2. If it's 17 or above, you only can boost it by 1. And so oftentimes I'll start with 16s, knowing that I can boost those up to 18s later, versus if I start with 17 or 18, I can only add 1 later.
Right.
So,
and if you're not, and if the campaign isn't going to go that long, it's not worth it to do so, maybe. So
I haven't done a short campaign yet with any of my characters. So
yeah, well, and there's also at the risk of seeming a little bit, you know, social engineering about it, you can also get a sense if somebody invites you to a game and they're the kind of GM whose games never go more than about 6 months before they get excited about something else and let the campaign mm-hmm. peter and die because they want to start something else. Well, you know, the Starfighter campaign isn't going to go much longer than that either. So you keep that in mind. That's been, you know, somebody pay attention to who you're playing with, who's running it, what they've run before. That's, you know, it's all part of determining what's going to make sort of the best, most thrilling kind of character for you to play at the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you concern yourself much with the theme as you're setting up your character? So the actual Starfinder theme of your character?
You know, to be perfectly honest, I'm looking at themes for what ability score modifiers it's going to give me. And that's kind of it, right? I almost wish, and I'm sure this exists online somewhere, that they were organized like, okay, here are the ones that give you +2 to charisma. look from these. Here are the ones to give you plus two to dex. Look from these.
They all only do one.
Sorry, one plus one. That's right.
Yeah, and actually the Archives of Nethys has a listing of all of them, and it lists what it affects. So when I'm making a character, that's actually one of the things, you know, I have all the books and I have all the PDFs. I go online because it's organized so much better by them.
Yeah. It's so much easier. That kind of organization is valuable. Even if you're only making stuff out of the core book, sometimes, all right, well, what feats are going to be available for me with these requirements? I mean, that's just, it's almost like, I mean, and it comes from the fact that a rule book is primarily a reference book, and you want to get at reference material sometimes multiple ways. Right. Multiple sort of filters. So it is useful. I'm on Archives of Nethys all the time as well.
Yeah. And yeah, well, I think for writing, the archives are great. The search mechanisms in there, you know, so if you want to find something in particular about, you know, what's happened on Triaxis or whatever, and, historically, you can put it in there. He's done a really good job. And, you know, he was doing some writing in one of the books that we're working on together. And he was typing in Discord, and you know, the Discord that we had for the book, and he's talking about searching his database to find all instances of a particular thing, and all the other authors were asking him to look up stuff for him and do things. And it's like, yeah, but you could do it yourself. And until that point, I didn't realize how well indexed it was and how refined you could look for things. Using the search algorithm it has.
That's not bad. Here's a thing that I haven't been told not to say it. So at Paizo, we have files that contain all of the products we've ever done. And so you can do a search for Triaxis, for example. And not only are you going to get a lot of Starfinder products, but you'll ping any of the Pathfinder products where Triaxis was mentioned.
Right.
One of the volumes of the Reign of Winter Adventure Path and Distant Worlds and, you know, any place somebody might have mentioned Triaxis. And that's super useful. But that centralized database of products, the search didn't work all the time. But, I mean, when it did work, super effective, super useful. But we can't get that remotely because we're sort of coming in electronically to the systems in a different and more limited way. So I've really been missing that ability.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. Anyway, so getting back to character generation.
Okay.
So yeah, using the archives, I think, is really useful for looking at what themes might work. And also if you want alternative class features and things, because they're all listed out there. So say you want to, you know, have a different flavor of envoy, a different flavor of soldier. You want to make a medic or something. You know, all these things are kind of listed out there. Generally, I start up with the basic idea. I figure out what race it's going to be, what class it's going to be, and then I start massaging it with that other stuff. The mechanical part of it. You know, so I know a lot of folks that use Hero Lab to kind of build out their characters. Mm-hmm. Like Scott uses Hero Lab. I don't do that. I actually have a fillable PDF form, and I don't know where I got the first one online.
Hmm.
And I've since used them for every iteration of all my characters. I will just, you know, like I have a character named Gunter. I was running through something I'm looking at. So I have Gunter, you know, level 1, level 2, level 3, all the way to Gunter level 9, right? And I just, every time I level him up, I make I copy the previous PDF and I level them up and do things on it. Because the nice thing about the fillable PDF is, you know, you fill in some parts of it and it automatically populates some other parts. You know, so if you have your ability scores, the modifiers automatically get added to your, AC and to your skills and things like that. And I like it for organizing my character. You know, I've tried to do it pencil and paper. And oftentimes I forget how things are connected. And so the fillable PDF is a nice way to do it. And you don't need to be you don't need to be online to do it. You can do it with a laptop that's not connected to the internet or an iPad or something like that.
That's not a bad idea. I am myself a Hero Lab user. I really like the Hero Lab online. I initially sort of balked because of the same issue that I didn't want to have to be online in order to be able to use it. But I'm a have a piece of paper in front of me to play a character kind of guy anyway. So I just print out what I got from Hero Lab. Now that we play mostly electronically all the time anyway, Hero Lab is even more useful than it was before. But it doesn't have, you're right, it doesn't, unless you're saving your character anew each time, it doesn't have a lot of sort of version control. You can't go back and say, now, what did this character look like at second level? And what was I doing then? And sometimes that would be useful.
Well, one reason why I like it is because I'll build multiple, you know, I have multiple operatives, for example. So I have one I used in an AP. I have one that I used in society play. I made a new one for society play. I made another one for an AP. And so I'll actually go back to the first level of those other operatives and see how I built them out and then look at the progression, what I liked about it as they leveled and what I didn't like, so I can adapt my new one to be different, you know?
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, that. So there's more than just more that version control gives you when you're making the next character down the line. That's really neat.
Yeah, like you were talking, remember when we did a play test, we had to level our characters up to 18 or something for your thing. You know, so I had a level 13 character, so I said, okay, I'm going to start with this one and go up with it, you know? So just to have a start, because it's, I mean, you could start from scratch on everything. I mean, it works. But anyway.
That might get kind of tedious. But if we're talking, but back to starting from scratch, one of the things that I'll do before I dig into the specific mechanics of buying gear, even getting buying skill, you know, figuring out my skill points and things like that, one of the things that I'm going to do is pick the kind of the, what you would call theme earlier, not theme mechanic, but kind of the shtick for the character.
The shtick.
And that's what I'm going to pick. Like when I was doing when I was doing Scooch, my thinking was, okay, well, I want to be an operative, and it looks like Yosoki does really well with operatives. I can see like a little rat person scurrying around, and that'll be fun. And when I was looking at the different types of operatives, and I saw the survivalist, and I'm like, oh, that, you know, I want to be an explorer. I want to be out and about and learning all the different, you know, being able to use the environment to your advantage was part of that description. I thought, oh, that actually, I can always have some sort of description about in the middle of a fight. So explorer, that's the way I want to go. And then I started thinking to myself, what kind of little survivalist rat person could there be? I'm like, well, they're big on putting stuff in their cheek pouches. Oh, you know, I can run with that. I can be all about eating stuff. And that's when I built the whole backstory of having been a, sort of having coming off of some television fame for the show Scooch Eats It, where I would go to all these different worlds and eat all this different stuff. That then informed a lot of the other choices. In fact, that informed my theme, because I picked Icon specifically because I wanted to be that as my background. So once I got past, for example, taking survival, which is a valuable skill for an explorer, the necessary skill for an explorer operative, after that, it was, all right, well, what's going to be kind of fun for me to have done based on the kind of shtick that I want to be?
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I'll be honest, I often don't get that deep into the characters when I'm making them originally, you know, from the start. Primarily for society play, you know, I'll have a little bit of backstory, but not a lot. And usually it goes with, you know, like, Leroy Jenkins is an easy one. And then, like, when I was playing, when you were GMing Book 4 for Dawn of Flame, and I was making my my operative to fill in for Scooch, your operative, you know, I wanted to make I had a Tiefling boon for society play. And I thought, you know what, I want to try making a Tiefling in the AP just to see how it runs. And I thought, man, that looks an awful lot, that looks an awful lot like, you know,
Daredevil. Yeah, the superhero
outfit. So yeah, so that's kind of what I, you know, based Murdoch's on, you know. But I, again, a little bit of shtick there, but he wasn't a crime fighter and stuff. You know, his profession is lawyer, but he hasn't had the opportunity to use that much.
But you're also being able to see in the dark and use the dark advantage. Yeah. You leaned into that, I think, really well.
Yeah. So that's kind of fun, you know, to do. But I, you know, a lot of my characters, you know, like my very first character I made for society is Oh man, I don't even know his full name. I gotta look it up.
it was so long ago.
Well, no, because so he has a nickname, right? So it's his name is Juanito Esperanza Riccoli, but everybody calls him Rico. And basically, do you know who Johnny Rico is?
I don't. Okay. Should I? Is this another pop culture blind spot I'm in?
Well, it's a small one, you know. So Johnny Rico is like one of the main characters in Starship Troopers.
Okay. All right. I'm remembering now.
Yeah. He's the football player and he's the one that leads everybody in. And so I was making it, you know, I was thinking, I'm going to make Johnny Rico. So basically I made my soldier to do that. And so I didn't want to call him Johnny Rico. So I called him, and Johnny Rico's actually from South America in the show, right? Mm-hmm. So he's going to be Juanito Esperanza Riccoli, which, you know, basically he's going to be Johnny Rico. You know, and so that's kind of how I built him out. But there's a little bit of backstory there, but not a ton, you know. Mm-hmm. It's more, I like to make plays on words. I have another character that's, his name is Montgomery J. Morelia. And he was a pilot for a traveling circus performer group. And so basically, Morelia is a type of large snake, similar to a python.
Okay.
And so basically, Montgomery J. Morelli is Monty Python.
Flying circus. And
so that was kind of the play on that. You know, so I just do goofy things like that. You know, I have another character named Deckard K-493.
Okay.
He's an android. And K-493 spells Kane. Do you know who Deckard Kane is?
Yep. Deckard Kane, I know. I got one. I got one. Blade Runner.
Yeah. No. Deckard is actually in Blade Runner. Deckard Kane is actually from the video game Diablo.
I missed then.
Yes.
I missed my pop culture. All right. I didn't get one. I'm 0-2.
And then in our game in society, when we were playing the AP, I had Bishop 2K7.
2007?
Well, 2K7. Do you know where that phrase comes from? Bishop 2K7.
I don't.
So that's actually from Blade Runner. So when they're going, I don't know if you remember, they're going up the elevator and they're trying to get into the guy's penthouse, and the little inventor guy is playing chess with him. So he tells him, Bishop to K7, in order to get the conversation going, and then he gets let in. So that was kind of, I thought, okay, I'll do that. And then Bishop, there's actually a couple different bishops out there that are operative types. And one of them, Jason Statham, plays a character named Bishop, who's like an assassin operative kind of thing. So I thought, oh, this is really fun. I'll put a couple of different. So that's a lot with my names, is I try to work things in and then build something off of that. Nobody ever gets them. So I finally get a chance to tell everybody on the podcast. So if you see one of my characters, you know, Garth Algar, do you know who that is?
Garth Algar?
Yeah, that's the name of my biohacker. He's a dwarf.
I don't. Algar is a type of, isn't that a type of petri stuff you put in a petri dish? What is the stuff you put in a petri dish to make stuff grow?
I know what you're talking about. Garth Algar is actually Dana Carvey's character in Wayne's World.
So. Wayne and Garth.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. So I just do really goofy things like that. So I'm not a real serious role player. I just like to make names. So
see, and I try to keep the names to be things that could be in world, right? I had, you know, Kelber Hollis, my envoy for our Dead Sons campaign. I mean, it didn't mean anything. It just sounds, somebody could have a name like Kelber Hollis, Mr. Hollis, or, you know, Kelber to his friends. And then Scooch is, you know, Yosoki have their tendency for nicknames, and somebody could kind of scooch on by you. And that's
right.
That's about as jokey as I get, because I think to myself, these people live their lives within the world and they're not going to have something where they're mocked all the time for. But I know I'm, you know, that's just one of many perspectives, right? I've sat down with some of the goofiest named people ever at some of the society tables, and that's fun, and they like that. think it's kind of a, you know, kick out of people.
Well, I like to make my names that they don't sound goofy, but they're like an inside joke, and I just wait for somebody to get it.
Yeah, yeah.
And hardly ever.
Winking a nod at the table. That's
Yeah. Sam Jack, some people get that one.
I could get that. Samuel Jackson, is that?
Yeah.
Okay. Whoa, yeah. Okay, one. I'm like 1 in 4 now.
He's my envoy. He's my second envoy I have, so he's very, you know how Raz really yells at people to get them going?
Yep, yep.
Sam Jax is the same.
Does the same. Shouts at people. I can see that.
So, all right. Anyway, so, so that's kind of how I go about making characters, you know, getting them started, get some inspiration, go through the mechanics, figure out, you know, what races you want to have them do. With themes, same as you, I just kind of look for a couple that have a good modifier that I'm looking for. Oftentimes it's a modifier to dex or a primary stat, and then pick which one might have some flavor for the basic character I'm making.
And then what I'll do is I'll use whatever the theme is, because I'll pick the theme pretty much mechanically, but then that'll feed into the type of character that I'm going to be playing and what I'm going to do. So
All right, well, I think this has not been a very technical discussion, but I think it's good to show that there's lots of different ways to develop and start characters. You don't have to be super serious about it, or you can be very mechanical about it, or whatever.
Yeah, and that is one of the things that I've said to people when they're just agonizing over, man, where do I put this skill rank versus where do I put this particular, you know, ability score upgrade? I'm like, hey, the game's not hard. Right, it's not intended to be just a real grindy deathmatch of a game where every single decision in character generation matters or character advancement matters. So you can pick something that's fun and you'll do fine. So that, of course, you know, isn't the case if the GM who's inviting you to the game points out, oh, well, this is going to be a grueling deathmatch on a prison planet. That's my whole campaign. All right, well, then you might want to agonize over every choice, but.
You know, what's interesting is I'm joining a Age of Ashes game. They had a character, one of their players had to drop out. I'll tell you who later. And they invited me to fill in, and they're at level 9. And so I have to make a level 9 Pathfinder second edition character. And I haven't even made a level 1 character yet in second edition. So it's actually, you know, I'm going to be agonizing a lot because I, you know, there's a lot of freedom to build something up to level 9. And not knowing what the optimal should be or what I should do, it's going to be really interesting.
All right. Well, then let me back up and say, you know, Age of Ashes tends to be key. People say it's keyed a little bit to the higher end of difficulty. So maybe you do need to pay attention to every single, you know, skill training.
Don't tell me that. Yeah, I was, I was thinking I might do one of the playtest characters, you know, a gunslinger, or I was actually thinking inventor would be kind of fun.
That would be really neat. We're really excited about how the gunslinger and inventor playtests have been. I had to sit on my hand several times to not type out, oh, that's going to be so cool and you're going to love it and you're going to, you know, you're going to find it a blast, right? Things like that I couldn't even say because I knew that would be giving too much information away.
Well, a lot of people were wanting to see the gunslinger, I think. So that's an obvious one. The inventor, though, I don't know anything about it. What's can you give me a thumbnail sketch on that?
It is a super customizable, techie kind of person. So you want to have a little friend, you want to have a, you know, sort of a suit of armor that you customize, that you tinker with. That's what you make. I think there could be people, of course, that disagree with me. I think that the nanosite is maybe the best analog for the inventor because the nanosite has a lot of different builds that let you do different things. But once you pick kind of a path, that's what your character is going to do. Mm-hmm. And inventor feels very much the same way to me.
Right. So you have a couple of major areas that your class can do. And once you pick a direction, then you focus on things to build up that direction.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And, you know, if you try to spread out to do a lot of the different things, you're going to be not as good in any of them. But could still have a really good time. The thing I'm most excited about, the Inventor, is that it's the first class we have for Pathfinder 2nd Edition that's new, that wasn't a Pathfinder 1st Edition class.
Right.
So if it's received very well, that's going to tell us, hey, do more like that. Break new ground more often. And if it doesn't do well, then, well, we know there are things that have done particularly well in the past, the Kineticist and things like that, that maybe we'll just stick with some of the old favorites, knowing that people really want to be able to see their old favorites in the new edition, and maybe we'll do that. So we'll see. We'll see how people take it.
Yeah, well, I'm excited to give it a go, and so I'll be working diligently this week. You know, so my GM, if they're listening, will know that I've put some thought into this character. So,
all right. When are you going to be playing in the next couple of weeks? Are you going to be playing your first session there?
Week from tomorrow. So, yeah. Huh.
Maybe one of the things that could be really useful for us to talk about in Starfinder is what it's like to join a group, what it feels like the first time you're sitting at the table with these people and sort of getting yourself involved with sort of that kind of, you know, that sort of group social dynamic. Happens all the time at society tables, where you're sitting down with a bunch of people, some of whom you may know, some of whom you may not know, but what that kind of dynamic is like to sit and play.
You know, I was actually a little worried about it because I know the GM and I know one of the players. I don't know any of the other players. And so it's going to be interesting. I like the GM a lot, and I like the GM's wife, who's the player, a lot, you know, so they're good to play with. I asked them what are the other folks like, and they said, well, they're okay, they're a little, you know, just different, but you know, they're fine. So I'm really curious to see how it's going to go. I said as long as they don't mind, I'm a complete noob at second edition. You know, I'll come in at ninth level and just screw everything up and ask all kinds of dumb questions and stuff. Hope that's okay. And so they said, yeah, you'll pick it up quick. And, you know, I got all the books. I do read through them and stuff. I haven't made a character. That's the big thing, you know. I understand the system, how it works. I just haven't made a character. I haven't really – nobody's invited me to play before.
Well, here you go. This is the opportunity you've been waiting for.
Yeah, I'm excited. All right, so I think that's about it. Now we did go a little bit into something outside of Starfinder, heaven forbid, but I think that's probably okay.
That's true, but I think we could pull it around to Starfinder when we get together next time.
Yep. All right. Well, I'm John,
and I'm Ron, and this is Digital Divination.